This is 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. It's November 9th, 2020. Welcome to Bicycle Talk with my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch, a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show and are listening on Facebook Live, you can leave comments at the Bicycle Talk Facebook. We are recording our shows live now on Mondays using Facebook Live and then playing them at our normal times on Wednesday at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, or you can stream us at whus.org. If you have any other comments, you can send them to me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. We will continue to do this until we are allowed back at the UConn campus. Doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime real soon, so here we are, right here live in Mansfield Center, Connecticut. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, the management, or the licensee of this station. Ron's Rant of the Week. Okay, so there's these right things out there, these detection devices, which what they do is they let you know when a car is coming up behind you and, you know, just kind of give you an idea of, you know, how fast or whatever. And it's just a great thing. And it's made by one company, just one, Garmin. They're the only ones that make it. Big endorsement for Garmin here. Big no-no to Garmin right here. Where's the technology? Who's got this thing licensed and why is it protected so well that nobody else has come up with a competing brand of detection device? Nothing against Garmin because they put the research into it. They've got it all figured out. Obviously they're going to try to make back as much of that marketing or that research money that they put out there. But I want some competition here because they're expensive. It's really expensive. I'd love to have that information. I think it's a really cool thing. I think it's a piece of information that, quite honestly, there are some big, big cell phone companies out there and big platforms out there, not to mention the one that has a piece of fruit connected to it, that could easily develop something like this, not just for cyclists, but also for pedestrians. So if you're crossing the street and somebody comes up on you super fast with a vehicle, maybe your phone would alarm you or something. Or better yet, someone want to really develop this and get crazy with it, alarm the vehicle that has the GPS on their car that they've got someone they're going to hit because they have an electronic device that is then communicating with the car. Just a thought. So anyway, that's my rant of the week. Detection devices for oncoming vehicles. Why is Garmin all alone here? What's the big deal? On a positive side, let's do a little shout out here to Bike Walk Bolton. Bike Walk Bolton did a cleanup last week on Wednesday, and a bunch of people showed up. A big shout out to all those folks that I saw on their Facebook page. They did a great job of cleaning up some of the places where water collects. You know, there are ditches off to the side of the trail that keep the water off the trail. But this time of year, they fill up with leaves and sticks and all sorts of debris. So Bike Walk Bolton put together a trail cleaning and they cleaned it up. And that's a great thing. Wonderful. Big shout out to Bike Walk Bolton. Another big shout out to Bike Walk Bolton. Let's talk about this too. They are currently investigating and coming up with a solution to lighting the tunnel. Fran, you know the tunnel on up in Bolton Notch, right?
Sure.
It's pretty dark in there. And yeah. It's dark in there, not just during the nighttime, but also during the daytime.
Yeah.
So what they're doing is they put out a study and they're working on maybe some grant money to take care of this and put some lights in the inside of the tunnel. You know, it's super easy to do with solar panels. One solar panel will probably light up that whole tunnel and probably keep it lit into the night. Just saying, that would be a nice idea too. I've got solar lights that I use just right here at my house, and they light up our whole yard. And they don't stay on all night. They only stay on when there's motion detected, but it's a super easy thing to do. And the technology is already there. So it seems like it'd be a great, great addition to what they're doing up there. Anyway, simple stuff. Hopefully it'll get taken care of soon. I'm sure that they'll come up with a far more industrial system than what I have just lighting up around my house. But anyway, that's another really, really good thing on the positive side. Bike Walk Bolton is doing some great stuff on the Hop River Trail in Bolton Notch. So a little shout out to them. A shout out again, as I do every week, with the Airline Trail North, the TAP grant that is happening to put the bridge in to cross Route 44. The update now is the week of November 16th, and we're going to have a big bridge brought in that's going to cross over Route 169. Possibly one of the most dangerous crossing intersections on the Airline Trail North. So that's really, really exciting. And it looks like Needles Eye Road, that bridge that they're putting in there too, it seems like a lot of the concrete work is done at this point, or very, very close to being done. So really excited to see these things come in. It's going to be great. We're going to have just the most incredible and awesome rail trail going all the way from East Hampton, Connecticut, all the way to Putnam, Connecticut. And that's pretty much, except for a couple little pieces here and there, a nonstop shot through. So really cool stuff. Can't wait until it happens. It'll be just great. So anyway, moving on. The maintenance minute. Next thing on my list, the winter bike. Okay, let's talk about the winter bike. Do you have a winter bike? Fran, do you have a winter bike? Fran has a winter bike. She just doesn't ride it like a winter bike. But anyway, we're going to talk about that a little bit. We're going to get that out there. Why do you want to ride a winter bike in the winter, even though it's a gorgeous, beautiful day out? And, you know, let's say you've had a lot of snow and you've had a lot of bad weather, and now all of a sudden you get one of those gorgeous, beautiful days. What do you want to do? You want to go grab that road bike that you love so much, and you want to take it out. It's your premier bike, and you want to take it out and go for a ride. You get back, and it is covered in sand and grit and slop all over the place. Now you got to clean it all down. If you're responsible about your bike, you got to go through this whole cleaning thing. Don't do that. Don't do that. Hang that bike up on the hook after you've checked it out all for the wintertime. Maybe you put a new cassette on. Maybe you put a new chain on. You know, you cleaned it up. It's perfect. It's pristine. It's ready to go for the first beautiful day out there. Don't make the first beautiful, bless you, Fran. Don't make the first beautiful day out there the day that there's still a lot of slop on the road, which is just going to take all your work and all your effort in cleaning that bike up and turn the bike into ick again. Ride your winter bike. So what's a winter bike? Well, my winter bike is a cyclocross bike. I can improvise a set of fenders on it. I can basically go ride it like I do my cyclocross bike and not worry about it so much, because that's kind of what it's made for. It's kind of made to do a little bit more, you know, that dirt road cyclocross type stuff. So it's a perfect winter bike if you don't have one. Maybe it's your mountain bike. Maybe you just use your mountain bike for the winter bike. If you are a mountain biker, your mountain bike is always your winter bike. It's always your summer bike because it's your mountain bike. But you might have one of those bikes that you kind of like to keep a little bit nicer. And then maybe your old bike or your second bike that you might have. Because what's the correct number of bicycles, Fran?
N plus one.
N plus one, absolutely. So you can never have enough bikes. But anyway, you want to use that secondary bike for the winter because it really, really makes sense. Hi, Jed. How you doing? How's everything over at the Cycling Advancement Program? Yay. Good program, by the way, folks. Really good. We talk about them a lot on the show. They're wonderful. So anyway, your winter bike. I use my cross bike. These gravel grinder bikes that a lot of people are getting into makes a great winter bike. It really does. It's perfect. I'll talk about this in future shows a little bit more about why should I put fenders on my bike and look ridiculous with fenders on my bike. Well, I can give you many reasons why. We'll get into that the next time. I had people that used to give me a hard time showing up on a road ride with my fenders on my bike, but we'll talk about that in another show. So let's move on to the content of the show. Last week, I was finishing off the show with what is a rep worth anyway, and I got to the very end, and it was called The Bottom Line. And The Bottom Line was, you know, after going through the details of why you want to hire a rep to represent your product in the bicycle industry, I'm sensitive to this because I was a rep in the bicycle industry. I was in the industry for 44 years. So I have a lot of concern about this because there are a lot of companies that they did a lot of online business this year. Why did they do a lot of online business? Because of COVID. So now they're looking and seeing, well, do I really need a rep or not? And so we talked about that all last week. There was a great article in Bicycle Retail and Industry News about it. And we talked a lot about that. And so at the end, there is the bottom line. So I'm going to get to the bottom line on this. This came from an article in Bicycle Retail and Industry News. And I'm going to read this out for you because it's important. It's definitely important. The value of a sales rep adds to the dealer-supplier relationship goes far beyond the next order, next preseason program, or the next quarter's results. In fact, once suppliers realize that retailers are their primary customers, a rep's value extends deep into the roots of customer satisfaction and therefore into that customer's lifetime value. What is required here is a fundamental shift, not just in the role of reps, but the entire retailer-supplier relationship. Brands that figure this out will be the ones to reap the benefits, and the rest will be left by the wayside. That means that dealer satisfaction with the rep may turn out to be the best indicator of how long and profitable a dealer relationship will be, which means reps should not only be compensated by their individual sales or territory growth, but how easy they make it to do business with the supplier. There are always retailers who will say, just get rid of the rep and give me their commission as margin points. Ooh, I had somebody do that to me once. This attitude may be tempted in theory, but it's a false choice and one that ignores the primary value that reps provide. Of course, if the rep fails to provide that value, it's another story entirely. But compensating reps, at least partly by retailer satisfaction ratings, will get you to the heart of the matter in short order. So, will this actually happen? Rep commission based on dealer ratings? Frankly, I doubt it. But at least not in the near term, because the overwhelming truth is that nowadays most suppliers don't see retailers as their customers, primary or otherwise. Dealers are merely a fulfillment vehicle to the real customer, the end customer. The hollow phrase dealer partners is belied by brands' marketing tactics. When was the last time you saw a bike or equipment that even mentioned the retailer, much less their added value? In the eyes of too many suppliers, the dealer is literally irrelevant to the selling proposition. So fortunately, there is a silver lining. Supplier attitudes are slowly changing more and more. There are more brands that realize that one key to doing more business is to make themselves easier to do business with. That was followed by a D-U-H. We use that here at Bicycle Talk a lot and around the house. Fortunately, so anyway, this is exactly what good reps do. So what is required here is a fundamental shift, not just in the role of reps, but the entire retailer-supplier relationship. Brands that figure this out will reap the benefits. A piece of the larger puzzle, sales reps and their compensation can be a small but critical step. At least it's a start. Best of all, it's a step that's relatively easy for brands to take and one that will yield genuine benefits almost immediately for suppliers and retailers alike. So that ends the bottom line of, is a rep worth it or not? Well, you know, obviously I'm very biased here and you will hear me say, but of course, why not? I mean, it's all about relationships. People sell to people. It doesn't matter what industry you're in, people sell to people. And if you think that you have this most incredible, outstanding product and you're going to get by resting on your laurels with that, you need to wake up. We're not there yet. With this year and the change that's gone on and the amount of people that are really forced into using their computers a lot more to do business, you still have to have a human in there somewhere. You really do. Makes a big difference. Puts out a lot of fires, solves a lot of problems. We're going to move on because there's much, much more to talk about. Oh boy, here we go. So the Vuelta is one of those things on my list today, of course, because the Vuelta is now over. And let me back up on that for a second. So I have another little piece here that is called Thank you all from the bottom of my heart. Pro riders react as strange and unpredictable 2020 season comes to an end. Yeah, the Vuelta was the end of the Grand Tour season, and it was really, really cool because we had three Grand Tours right in a row, and they all went off successfully. There were not any real major issues that I saw. I think the Giro probably had the worst problem, the COVID problem. They had two teams go home early because of COVID. We didn't see that in the other tours. And, you know, big tip of the cycling cap, or the new word out there that I'm learning through the European stream is chapeau to Tour de France for making it as clean as they possibly could. France is now not in such a great spot, so there may have been some sort of too many people out watching the tour or otherwise, but I think it was more related towards holiday or vacation, as they call it holiday over in Europe, than it was to anything else. A lot of people got together with their friends and family, and then they had COVID again. So, and the same thing happened in Italy, and, you know, and that was right in the middle of the Giro, and, or at the, actually, it was really, really close to the edge of the Giro. So that was it. The Vuelta, again, they have outbreaks again over in Europe. It's really sad and unfortunate. We are still the world leaders here in the United States for COVID outbreaks. We are just doing our darndest to become the best at that. No comment. Anyway, I think I just did. So anyway, back to the riders. A big tip of the cycling cap to the riders that were really good about staying strict with this. The supporting teams and what they did. You know, tireless work of race organizers, riders, teams, fans, and you know, just big time. Look at the other sports that are out there. Look at the sports that have made it through this. Look at the sports that are not functioning because of this. Look at the sports that we're going to just be watching on television this year because of this. And they have no fans in the stands. Cycling had fans. Cycling had a lot of fans. They were on the sides of the road. They were masked. They did the right thing. And it was just beautiful. So anyway, yeah, this is a big, big deal. I just needed to mention this in today's report because I thought that it was just a great thing. Thank you all to everyone that participated in the cycling industry. Another big thank you, Chris Froome. Chris Froome has moved on to another team. He spent 11 years with Ineos Grenadier. And, of course, it was Team Sky at first, and then it became Ineos, and then it went Ineos Grenadier. But he spent 11 years with them. He had an incredibly successful career, incredibly. And we watched him, and we all looked at him, and those of us, and I know all my friends here that have commented on this, we watched his awkward style on his bike, and yet he just tore it apart. And, you know, Chris Froome was just, he was a great person to watch. He sent out a wonderful tweet just a couple of days ago, thanked everyone, all of his fans and everyone who has watched him. He will be moving on to another team. There's another up and coming that's coming over with him. This should still be very, very interesting. I don't think he's gone yet. I think he's going to be around for a while. He, as many pros have had, he had a tough ending at Ineos because, you know, he had some bad crashes. He had some issues. It happens, man. It's a hard sport. It's a really, really hard sport. But anyway, so a tip of the cycling cap to Chris Froome, and thank you for everything that you've done for us who are fans who really enjoy the sport and what we're doing. The Vuelta. Let's move on. Okay. Anybody been watching the Vuelta out there? Did anyone watch the Vuelta? It's gone. It's over. We're done. I got to tell you, the last week of the Vuelta España has been one of the best times I've had, other than this year's Tour de France, watching bicycle racing. Back and forth and back and forth and constant attacks and seconds away from one another at the very end and even the last couple of days. Big, big, big tip of the cycling cap to Primoz Roglic. My God. You know, this guy, he was back and forth with the lead. There were mountain attacks. It was vicious. It was absolutely vicious. Richard Carapaz, huge tip of the cycling cap for making this the most interesting tour out there. Hugh Carthy, another one. Where did he come from? Unbelievable. Great, great stuff. Dan Martin, great stuff. They all worked super hard. There were seconds between first, second, third, and fourth up until a few days ago. Rogelijk came back with the time trial to end all time trials. He put it down. He felt it. He wanted that red jersey back. He wanted to be a two-timer in the Vuelta España, and he pulled it off. He put enough of a time gap on that everybody had to work super hard into the mountains afterwards, and the battle began, and Richard Carapaz, wow, I'm impressed. I'm really impressed. He gave it a hard effort, but he didn't quite pull it off. And he was second by 24 seconds. Just 24 seconds for second place in a long tour like that. That's amazing. And again, the excitement, you know, the screaming at the television set, if you had it on TV, or maybe on your computer. Oh, gosh, this is bike racing, folks. This is why I get excited about it. It's such a cool sport. Anything can happen. And we're not talking about anything can happen over 100 miles. Anything can happen over, you know, 2,200 miles. Big time. You know, there's all sorts of things that can happen. What did it tell me? In both the Tour de France, actually all three Grand Tours, your time trial is really important. How well you time trial on that bike has got to be a function that you really need to hone in on if you're going to be a professional athlete or even an amateur athlete if you're doing a multi-stage race. That time trial is critical. It really is. It made so many lead changes, so many, you know, okay, that's it. That's the end of this race. I mean, just the time trial. Big deal. Yeah, the climbers, yeah, they're definitely there, but they're all climbers. There's lots of Grand Tour climbers. There's lots of the GC guys that are climbers. To be a climber and then also to be able to time trial, that's special. That's real, real special. And so that's why I mention it. So we finish up the 2020 standings and the final classification of Primoz Roglic as the winner. And we have Richard Carapaz 24 seconds behind him in second place. Hugh Carthy from Great Britain and the EF Pro Cycling Team back at 1:15 in third place. Dan Martin from the Israel Startup Nation. That's where Chris Froome is going, by the way, at 2:43 back. And then Henrik Maas from Movistar. He finished fifth at 3:36 back. Just, you know, and all the others, even up to the top 10 rider, which I have to mention because it's Alejandro Valverde, who is a well-known name and famous Spanish rider. He was only 9:34 off of first place. Who would have thought? Who would have thought? So anyway, good stuff. Final points classification. Primoz Roglic, 204 points. By a long shot, because Richard Carapaz came in afterwards at 133 points and Dan Martin at 111 points. It's just, you know, close, close, close. Guillaume Martin from France was the mountain classification first place. Tim Wellens from Belgium, 34 points. That was 99 points down to 34 points. And Richard Carapaz, still in there at 30 points for third place. So good stuff. Youth classification, Henrik Maas from Movistar. Keep your eyes on him. He's young. He's fast. He's talented. We're going to be watching him. We finished fifth. We're going to be watching him. The youth that's coming into the sport is so incredibly inspiring. I love it. I just love it. I love it. Shout out to my friends over in Middletown. Youth cycling, yay. Yay, Jed. Keep it up, man. You're doing a great job. We're going to start seeing that youth coming out of the U.S. here real soon. We already do. We already are starting to see some very, very interesting riders coming out of the U.S. right now. Let's see if they come out of New England. Hey, Jed, put some heat under that. Let's see what we can do. Not to pressure anyone, but put some heat under that. So team classification for the Vuelta was Movistar number one, Jumbo Visma was number two. Astana Pro Team was number three. The UAE Team Emirates was number four. And Mitchelton Scott was number five. So that's your Vuelta. I don't have a lot more, except I do. I have five talking points here to bring from. Well, this is five talking points from stage 18. God, the mountain stages were just ridiculous. I thought I had a different one here, but I guess I didn't. So we'll go back to that one later. But anyway, I would say the talking points I probably already mentioned, the time trials. Time trials were key. The mountain stages, ridiculous. You know, just hard fought climbs. Just you know, I'm watching these guys climbing up heavy double digit climbs, some up to 20%. And they're just, I mean, it brings tears to my eyes to see somebody working that hard when they're doing stuff like that. Just incredible. Incredible, great climbs, great attacks, great stories that go along with the whole thing. It was really, really fun. Just a fun race to watch. A big congratulations to Primoz Roglic again. It's his second in a row. He won last year. He won this year. That's a two-timer. That's a big deal. That means he's to watch. And he was not sitting back and not paying attention in the Giro either. He was right there. It's great to see. I just think we have a lot of really good things going on here. There's some great pictures online. I'll try to post this one. And it's the top three riders from the Vuelta riding together with their arms around each other on their bikes as they're riding down the road. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool stuff. So anyway, good stuff if you like bike racing. And I do. And we do talk about it a fair amount. But that's what we do here. On my list. All right. I am going to go to, we have a couple of fun things. Everybody knows who Eddie Merckx is, who listens to the show, I would imagine. If you don't know who Eddie Merckx is and you listen to the show, get an education, come back next week, and then we'll talk a little bit more about Eddie Merckx. But Eddie Merckx is by far, in my opinion, the best cyclist that has ever competed in bicycle racing. Absolute number one. He won everything. He won the world record, the hour record. It's just the guy is just like, he is phenomenal. And he was nicknamed the Cannibal. He was just an outstanding rider. Just, you know, you can't. Fast Eddie. Loved watching Fast Eddie. And yes, folks, these were in the days when, do you remember when your brake cables came out of the top of your brake levers? Remember that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, go back there. Do you remember when your shifters had nothing to do with your brake levers, but they were down on the down tube of your bike? Mm-hmm. Yep, we're going back in the day. Okay, Eddie Merckx has the best record of any male pro racer ever. You name it, Merckx won it, except the Paris Tours, which gave another 70s lovely a one-liner. He was Noël van Tygeren. A Belgian like Merckx, and in 1972, Van Tygeren won the Paris Tours, a real classic in its day, but he didn't win much else in his career. Otherwise, and Noel is no longer with us, sadly, but he would say to anyone that would listen, Eddie Merckx and I dominated the 70s. I won the Paris Tours, and Eddie won everything else, and he did. Anyway, so how did Eddie Merckx train? I've got books that I've read, and it's, I don't know how you do that, but he did it. He did some crazy stuff, including taking a train as far away from his house as he could handle to ride home, and then riding home. Got to get home, right? There's where food's waiting for you. You know, you got to get back home. So that's what he would do. And this was like classic Merckx. So sometimes he was just out all day arguing that big races lasted up to 7 hours. So 9 hour rides are good for the body and good for the mind. 9 hours on your bike. Think about it. That's 9 hours of not like, you know, slow tour, stop at every convenience store type riding. We're talking about 9 hours of training. It's hard. It's really, really hard. The only thing you stop for is to fill your water bottle and then keep going. And everything else, you're packing in your pockets and off you go. And yeah, 9 hours. Merckx also did a lot of motor pacing to put zip in his legs, and he rode six-day races in the winter to keep his speed up and his weight down. And he did fight with his weight, because I saw Eddie, maybe 3 or 4 years after he had retired from being a bike racer. I saw him at the U.S. bike show, and he was a bit portly. He had gained some weight. He definitely had gained some weight. But, think about it. He's like a human incinerator as far as food went all that time when he was racing his bike. And then all of a sudden you stop, and if you continue the habit, you'll get a lot larger. So you have to make some adjustments when you go that. But anyway, he virtually took no rest, which is right now a very arguable thing. Many, many coaches and trainers push really, really hard, and they don't rest. And you got to rest. The new thought is more rest. And you get better performance with more rest. But anyway, Eddie didn't do that. And look what he did. He won everything. So maybe there's something to be said here. I don't know. We'll see. So here we go. Here's a typical week of what he did before his first Tour de France race in 1969. I read this and I just went, the week before? On Sunday, he raced in the Belgian National Championships, which was 264 kilometers. No walk in the park. On Monday, he did two races, a 110-kilometer criterium and an evening track meeting. On Tuesday, he raced in a Kermesse, but retired after 35 kilometers because he'd been prevented from starting with the rest of the riders by people demanding his autograph. How about that? Wednesday, he trained with his team, 180 kilometers. Thursday, he trained on his own, 270 kilometers. On Friday, behind Aderny for 50 kilometers, he was scheduled to be longer, but the torrential rain made it too dangerous. So he's motor pacing. Saturday morning, 40 kilometers, fast. Afternoon, 40 kilometers, easy. Evening, the prologue of the Tour de France. This is before he raced. The prologue. The prologue, of course, was a time trial. Merckx won 6 stages in that tour, 7 if you count the team time trial. He took the yellow jersey by almost 18 minutes. He won the green jersey, the King of the Mountain jersey, and the combined classification and the combativity award. He walked home with a whole crowd of jerseys. So hard work does pay, especially if your name is Eddie Merckx. So I just thought I would bring that up for all of you who go, well, I'm going to be a big, tough guy. Nobody's tougher than Eddie. Nobody. And no one since then has come close to Eddie Merckx. We had a little... a little tickle from Mr. Armstrong, which he lost all of his humor later on. He was starting to look like he was going to be a big deal. They had him slated for 7 wins on the Tour de France, but it's the only race he ever focused on. He didn't focus on anything else. That's it. Eddie did them all. Eddie's the best. I don't care what you say. Eddie's the best. There are other great riders in there. No question about it. But Eddie Merckx truly is, he stands alone as far as that goes. So I couldn't help but, when I saw this article, I went, oh, I got to talk about this. This is just the coolest thing. I found a couple of other things here with a little bit of humor in here. The 5 worst cycling inventions. So those of you who have been around as long as I have, you've seen a few of these for sure. Definitely seen a lot of these for sure. Things that were invented for cycling that were going to be, the next best state of the art. Here it is, starting with 1. There's great cycling innovations, but there have been some stinkers too. And this comes from Cycling Weekly, one of my favorite British sites. I love these guys. Here's our pick of the first 5 worst inventions to ever grace the world of cycling. See if anybody remembers any of these. Anyone remember a Canadian by the name of Steve Bauer? pretty hot rider in this day. If you don't remember the name, then you were probably born far after I was. So anyway, but I remember Steve Bauer. So Steve Bauer had a custom Eddie Merckx bicycle made for him, okay, that he was going to ride, or he did ride in the Paris-Roubaix, because everyone is, you know, the Paris-Roubaix is just, it's cobblestone after cobblestone, and then you get smooth road, and then you get more cobblestones, and then you get more smooth road, and you get cobblestone, and these roads are ancient. They are ancient. There's actually people out there that preserve the integrity of the ancient roads, believe it or not, so that the cobbles remain. And if the roads get too badly broken, they repair them to a certain degree, but not to a lot, because you don't want to take away the character. So anyway, Steve Bauer took things a step further in 1993, riding a radically designed bike that would take the sting out of the infamous pavé, all right, with a 60-degree seat tube angle. Now, bear in mind that most of us are riding still at this time with the conventional 73-degree seat tube, okay? That's kind of normal. Sometimes you see people with 74s, occasionally with 72s. LeMond kind of introduced the 72-degree seat tube as a little bit more comfortable bike, different feel. But anyway, you know, that's kind of where it's at. So 60-degree seat tube, we're talking like, you know, even more slack than a mountain bike in many cases. Pretty slack angle. A whopping 109-centimeter wheelbase and a RockShox suspension fork. Yeah, they made a RockShox road fork. They really did back in the day. Super comfortable bike. Was a dream to ride over the rough surfaces. But the bad news for Bauer was that with 4/5 of the Paris-Roubaix made of normal tarmac, it was a bit rubbish. A bit of rubbish for the rest of the race. And the Canadian would eventually finish in the 21st position. So great, strong rider. Awesome rider. Picked the wrong bike. Sometimes you just got to tough it up, Steve. Deal with the bumps. I mean, the bumps, they hurt too. And if you have raced any cyclocross, or if you've raced on any pavé or any really, really rough roads for an extended period of time, your forearms just start like twinging and burning, and it hurts. It's hard. It's really, really hard. But you know, that's bike racing. It's all part of it. And of course, you don't want to fall on that stuff. That's just not a good idea at all. But anyway, number two on the list of the worst cycling inventions. This is a good one. I had a set of these. A lot of people had a set of these. I used to work for this company. I rep for them for years. They were in Wilton, Connecticut. Anybody know who they are before I mention it? Okay, that was my hint. Wilton, Connecticut. Spinergy Rev-X wheels. All right, so Spinergy Rev-X wheels, if you're not familiar with them, they were these eight-spoke, because there was one blade on each side of the wheel, carbon wheels, and they were pretty comfortable to ride because they had a lot of carbon, a lot of give in them. They're pretty comfortable to ride, but they had some inherent problems. And one was if you nicked one of those little blades, they would eventually fatigue, sometimes catastrophically. Not good if you're racing on them. They eventually, I think they got banned because of because of the danger of them. But the 90s were heady days for bicycle engineers. Nothing was off limits, so it was clearly the one point in history where something like Spinergy Rev-X wheels could emerge. With 8 carbon-bladed spokes, they were certainly aerodynamic, and they saw much use in the contemporary pro Peloton. However, there were 2 drawbacks. Firstly, despite being aerodynamic, they weren't actually that good, both flexy and weighty. The bigger issue, though, was that they could be seriously dangerous. Not only were the carbon spokes liable to cracking, but having their sharp edges flying through the air was always a recipe for disaster. In fact, they were eventually banned by the UCI. See that? Reportedly, after a rabbit was killed in a cyclocross race and Paolo Bantini cut his hand in a crash. Yeah, they were bad news. They were ugly. Anyway, but, you know, everybody had to have them and they were a really cool thing. Okay, folks, here we go. Let's go back in time. I have some of these in my garage right now. By the way, they came on a bicycle that I inherited through the, we'll give this to Ron, see if he can do something with it. And, you know, you scavenge things and Shimano BioPace chain rings. Anyone remember those? Remember those? BioPace. They're elliptical sprockets. That's what they were. There's still controversy about elliptical sprockets out there. I never really saw the reason for them. They supposedly gave you more power on the downstroke. That's where your big power move is on your cycle. Anyway, non-round rings have enjoyed significant success in recent years, with Bradley Wiggins and Chris Froome both buying into thinking that the rings help to extend the amount of time the rider spends in the power phase of the pedal stroke, thus helping you ride faster for the same amount of power input. But despite this, there's still considerable debate about whether products such as Q-rings and asymmetric rings actually work. However, one product that didn't work was Shimano's BioPace chain rings, which had a similar design, but the chain rings rotated to a different angle. In effect, this meant that the time spent at the dead spots of the pedal strokes was increased, and the time spent putting down power was decreased, far from ideal. Anybody want some BioPace chain rings? I've got some. Anybody want them, just reach out to me. They are yours for free. So please. They're just elliptical throwing stars. So I would love to, if someone has some sort of a fondness to them, please let me know. I had a triple crank that had BioPace rings on it. I think it came from an old mountain bike or an old cyclocross bike. So anyway, moving on. Cinelli Spinacci bar extensions. So remember when Greg LeMond did the big time trial and he had a set of Scott clip-on bars on his bike and everybody's looking at this bike and going, what is that? And how could you ride with that? And of course he had a phenomenal time trial because he had an aerodynamic position and he basically put Scott on the map as far as cycling goes because they couldn't make him fast enough. It was a clip-on bar. And it was, you know, made him come forward a little bit, put him down in a more aerodynamic position, and gave you some speed. So anyway, everybody got in the game after that. And one of them that got in the game is our good friends from Cinelli. Cinelli, which made absolutely phenomenally good bars and stems and saddles. I rode on a Cinelli Unikiniter number 3 for years. What a great saddle. I have a friend who still has one. And he still rides it, and it's still in good condition. So, you know, anyway, Cinelli. So Cinelli did some cool stuff. Cinelli made some great bikes. Chino Cinelli made a number of custom bikes. I believe he made the bike that Merckx won the hour record on the track. So I believe that was a Chino Cinelli. I know it was a Chino Cinelli bike because I saw it, and now we're going to go way back in time. I saw it at the New York Bicycle Show at Columbus Circle in New York City, and they had it under glass, and I can tell a story that I've told to so many people that know me have heard this before, but they had it under glass, and if you looked at it really, really close, you could see there was a stain that was running down from the saddle down to the seat tube of the bike with droplets of blood. He rode himself raw to win or to set the hour record on the track. And I think he did that in Mexico City, but somebody can fact check me on that. Anyway, weenie bars. Yes, weenie bars they are. So, Cinelli Spinacci bars. And in and of themselves, there was probably nothing wrong with Cinelli Spinacci bar extensions. Set up correctly, they were essentially a more comfortable version of the time trial extensions designed to give you a more aerodynamic position, but without the discomfort of long hours in the saddle. What made the Spinaccis not only ineffective, but also pretty dangerous, was the way they were used and set up. During their time in the Pro Peloton, many riders either had them set too low, meaning loss of power, or too high, negating aerodynamic advantage. And while having 200 odd riders racing at high speed without having quick access to brake levers was always going to be a recipe for disaster. No wonder the UCI would eventually ban them in 97. Yeah, they allowed them in the mass start races, not just in time trials. It was bizarre. It was bizarre. I remember seeing people at the local races with them, and it's like, you have a lot of money to waste. That's okay. People did it, and there they are, and I'm sure there's a bunch of bikes out there with Spinacci still on them that are like classics hanging in people's garages or barns. So good for them. And then last on the top five list, the Mavic Mechtronic Wireless Shifting. Yeah, we have wireless shifting now. Somebody had to start it, right? Mavic started it. They, so with the fanfare that accompanied the launch of the wireless SRAM Red ETAP group set earlier this year, you'd be forgiven for thinking that this was the first wireless group set in the world ever seen. But in fact, it was way back in 1999 that the first such system was launched. The Mavic Mechtronic group set, 1999. Wow, going way back. Way, way back. That was, 99 was actually after I had sold my retail store. So yeah, the big things. And there were a lot of weird things that came out then. But anyway, that's what it was. Despite being highly innovative, there were a number of reasons the system didn't take off. Firstly, the wireless shifting only applied to the rear derailleur, and the mechanical shifting was on the front, and it was clunky at best. The shifters were also incredibly ugly, and the shifting could be sluggish because the system worked using radio waves, could be disrupted whenever you rode near a broadcast tower, and given the rear derailleur a mind of its own. How about that? So that's it. Those were the top five. I just found that and thought that would be a funny thing to talk about. Any of you out there have those? Anybody out there have one of those top five things that we just talked about? Send it over to your comments on my Facebook page, Bicycle Talk, or drop me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. I'd love to hear how you like them, if you still have them. And, I want to hear your comments. So please send it over. I'd love to hear more about it. So let's see. What else do we have here today? We got a few more minutes here, so we got a little bit more time to talk about some things. And we are going to just take a look here. I've got news from the bicycle industry. And I think that's where we're going to go. There's, let's see, that one we got to click out. We got, come on, I know it's here. So electric bicycle, this is for electric bicycle sales. So they're booming thanks to COVID. But there is a new problem. This comes from Electrek, which is a site that is all about electric bicycles. So, and where we're going here. And the COVID-19 pandemic basically shook the world and the bicycle industry with it. It also led to a huge surge in bicycle electric bike sales. Why? Because not everybody can ride a bike like some of my listeners out there. Some of my listeners out there are electric bike enthusiasts, and they are now riding their bikes a lot more because of the electric bicycles. So I'm not going to say anything bad about electric bicycles. I think that they're a great thing for the bicycle industry. They're all over Europe. They're exploding all over Europe. They're starting to show signs of explosion right here in the U.S. Electric bike thing is here to stay. I think we're going to see a whole lot more of it. And there are now actually companies, and I read this in another bicycle retailer article, that are pushing solar-powered bicycle recharging stations for free so you can charge your electric bicycle. So interesting stuff going on here in the bicycle world. Why are people looking at electric bicycles so much? Because if you live in a city, and like my son does, and you're trying to stay as far away from COVID as you can, which he has not, unfortunately, he's okay, but we're checking on him day to day. You don't want to get on a train. You don't want to get on a bus. You just don't want to do it. It's if you can be extremely careful, you can do it. And many people have to do it, especially the essential workers that we have out there who cannot afford transportation of any other kind. But a bicycle gives them an individual form of transportation and therefore becomes a far safer alternative. So what if you're not in very good shape and you are unable to ride a conventional bicycle like everyone else is? You put a little bit of power behind it and now you can get where you need to get. If it's a particular hot day, riding the bicycle can turn into a very sweaty, uncomfortable affair. An electric bicycle will get you to work a little bit cooler and a little bit drier. So electric bikes are big, big deal. So the e-bike business is starting to boom. There's so much boom on it that there's all sorts of legislation that's coming into place. Our National Park Service just approved the use of an electric bicycle in the national parks. These are... there's a lot of talk about, you know, do they belong in the bike trails? Do they belong in various areas? As I have always said, whenever you're riding a bicycle on a bike trail, if you are riding at the speed that the bike trail is dictating by the types of people that are riding on it, then you're okay. If you're out there to race your bike on the bike trail, get off the bike trail. Don't even think about it. I'm very opinionated about this. I will continue with my strong opinion about this. You just don't belong there. If you don't slow down when you see other people on the trail that are going much slower than you are, then you're not being very aware and very kind to others. So just my opinion. You'll get a lot of them on this show. So anyway, electric bikes. There's... The rate of selling the bikes nearly doubled overnight because of the demand that's out there. There's bikes that are being sold directly from China that are online that are really inexpensive. They're also no guarantees. So you buy it, you bought it, you may be stuck with it. It could happen. Do I recommend going to a retailer to do this? Absolutely. Do I recommend finding the retailer that knows what they're doing with this? Absolutely. We have one of the largest retailers. I'm gonna let you do your own research on this because I'm not here to promote anyone. But one of the largest retailers on the East Coast is right here in Connecticut. And I'll give you the clue. It's Bloomfield, Connecticut. So you can check there and see. But he's got a lot of bikes and he's got a lot of parts and he's got a lot of experience working on them. So that's a thing. I have a friend of mine, big shout out to Chris, who used to work for me, my very first employee, who's working on another innovative electric design right now. And he's a really smart guy. So we'll see what happens with it. We may be talking about it later on in a future show. But electric bikes are there and they're here to stay, and we need to learn how to deal with it. Do e-bike brick and mortar stores have an advantage? Absolutely. They know what they're doing. They've seen this before. There's a lot of things that you need to know about the electric bikes that are not typical of a regular bicycle. Yeah, they have wheels. Yeah, they have handlebars. But there's a lot of things electronically that you need to know about. So anyway, the electric bike business is definitely something that we need to pay attention to because it's happening, it's growing, it's here to stay. So let's see, what else do I have here? Oh gosh, I got lots of information here today, but unfortunately, if I dive into any of these, I would say that we're going to run out of time. So I'm going to pull up this thing that I saw from earlier, which I meant to bring up, and let's see if I can find the list here. There were some, these were the six key stages in the Vuelta, and I'm going to finish us off with this. Stage one, Primoz Roglic wins atop Mount Ararat, or it might be Arete. But anyway, that was the very first win. The first stage put him right in the red jersey right away. It was, he formed a group of, part of a group of eight favorites as they approached the summit, and he launched an attack, which was epic. And that was a really cool thing. Stage six, Richard Carapaz and Hugh Carthy regained time on Rose Leak at the Formigal. And again, another one of those vicious attack, hill attack races. Really, really cool stuff to watch if you're into bike racing. It's just wonderful. Stage 8, Rose Leak outpowers Carapaz at Moncalvillo. Again, just back and forth. That's why this race was so much fun to watch, because it was just like one day, another day. They're back and forth, lead changes, crazy stuff going on, seconds apart from all these guys. Just like really, really, really exciting. Stage 12, Rose Leak falters, but fails to crack on the Angliru. And what happened there is that was the one where he was fiddling with his jacket, I think. I'm not sure. But it was cold, it was rainy, it was hypothermia, and he lost a couple of feet, and that turned into a gap. And so, you know, things happened. So that was a big deal. So stage 13. Rose Leak sustains the pace in the final time trial. Just rode the time trial of his life, and that was the deciding factor. No one could catch him from that point. So those are the things that happen. And then he stayed in command on stage 17, which was again a big mountain stage, and Carapaz launched the attack that could have changed the race, and Rose Leak held his own there as much as he possibly could. So that was it. I just wanted to go over those. I'm glad I found that finally, because that was kind of a cool thing. And again, the Vuelta was fun, fun, fun. I've got some more information for you in future shows. We're going to start talking a little bit more about winter cycling, because, you know, it's moving indoors. And so I got some tips for you on what to do, and great training tips for keeping you fit during your winter cycling season. I've got... I'm going to have lots of input from Franny here on that, because she's pretty well sealed in on our Wahoo trainer downstairs. Yeah. She's having an awful lot of fun with that. Mm-hmm. So, and she can give us her perspective as to what it does for her. It's been great.
Hi, Patrick.
It's been great. And hello, Patrick, who she met from Singapore on, what is it? What's the app?
It's on Zwift.
So anyway, we'll talk a little bit more about that. Right now, I gotta call it a day. This is it. So what's next? What's coming up? Well, there is a Transport Hartford multimodal. Let's see here. I put it in here somewhere. Here, come on. That's not there. My friend Tony has a great little site. Anyway, now I'm not finding it. Anyway, you'll be able to find it on my Facebook page, and there is a November 23rd, there will be a 2020 Multimodal and Transit Summit, and there are going to be several topics on that for those that love bikes. More information, you can go to the Facebook page, and you will find a link to that. And check it out and see what's going on, because that's kind of a cool thing. And once again, that's November 23rd. If you want to get involved with that, you better check it out early. I don't have anything else to talk about as far as events go. So it's finishing points. Did you enjoy the cycling this summer? Did you enjoy the short season, but the unbelievable season that we had? Did you enjoy seeing all these young riders coming out that are, you know, just... it's the future. It's the future of bicycle racing as we now know it. There's a lot of things going on right now. There's a lot of changing going on right now. Here in the U.S., we have a huge change because we have a political change going on. That political change is going to lead us more in a, and it darn well better, because you're going to hear about it from me if it doesn't, into an alternative energy and alternative transportation system here in our country. And you know, I know it already exists worldwide, but we're looking forward to the change. We all are. So anyway, I'm really, really proud of you if you got out and voted. I had in my district that I was running the election for in my town, we had an 88% turnout for the vote. Amazing stuff, isn't it? Anyway, the views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. My name is Peddlin' Ron, and you have been listening to Bicycle Talk with my co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch. It's a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, and the bicycle business. If you've been listening on Facebook Live, you can send me a note there. This is Peddlin' Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores.